Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
When they fall from the tree and they're ripe, they sometimes will get kind of this bluish blush on them, and it's real gushy, and then you know it's good and ripe.
Vicki Bassman spends much of her work life wandering through Indiana State Parks, which means she's a pro persimmon forager. We have fun today doing some hunting and tasting with her, then a persimmon jam recipe with Chef Daniel Orr. Sheep farmers in Colorado are using the local food model to reinvigorate the wool economy. And we go to school with political science senior lecturer Christine Barber. She tells us the one thing that her freshmen and sophomore students are all surprised to learn about when it comes to their relationship with food. Let's get informed first thing today. Here's Luann Johnson.
Avoiding excess sugar and salt and other additives in packaged foods can seem overwhelming in a world where processed foods are designed around taste and not health. The Environmental Working Group wants to take the guesswork out of choosing quality packaged foods with its new smartphone app, EWG's Food Scores, Rate Your Plate. The app scans barcodes and delivers a score based on nutrition, additives, preservatives, and natural and artificial flavors. It goes beyond what the label says, providing a more thorough analysis, including BPAs, mercury, pesticide use, antibiotics in meat, and replacements for sugar and fat. EWG rates the products on a 1 to 10 scale, with 1 being the best and 10 being the worst. Scores 1 to 3.5 are considered a good choice, while 4 to 7 are of moderate concern, and 8 to 10 are of higher concern. What EWG found when analyzing some 80,000 different products was alarming. On average, the packaged foods contained 14 ingredients and consisted of 13% sugar by weight and 30% of the daily salt intake recommended by the Institute of Medicine. A study from Arizona State University found antibiotics in U.S. purchased shrimp, salmon, tilapia, and trout. According to a story from Food Safety News, researchers detected 5 different antibiotics in fish, one of which was present in farmed and wild shrimp. Another drug was detected in farmed salmon that was marketed as antibiotic-free. Drugs are not intended to spur growth in fish, but are instead added to the water at fish farms to treat and prevent disease. Sometimes drugs are also directly injected into fish. Antibiotic levels detected in the study were all within legal limits. We've been giving updates on the ongoing drought in California over the past several months. The latest bad news? Pumpkins are being affected. The lack of water means pumpkins are smaller this year than normal, and some have ripened earlier than usual. And despite their thick orange skin, pumpkins are actually not that resilient when it comes to challenging growing conditions. One more story about pumpkins that caught our attention this week. Pumpkin carvers in the UK waste 18,000 tons of squash during their Halloween festivities. That's according to figures published in The Independent. Halloween is getting more popular overseas, to where 2 out of 5 people buy pumpkins this time of year. The article by Tom Bodden ends with a simple recipe for pumpkin soup. Mmm, yum. We have a roundup of these links on our website, so you can read more and share them on your Twitter or Facebook. EarthEats.org.
That pumpkin soup got me thinking. We have a chili recipe online that uses pumpkin, and yeah, it's good. We'll post that on our Twitter feed so you can reference it while you're cooking tonight. Luann Johnson, great to hear from you.
Anytime, especially when pumpkin soup is involved.
We often think about foraging for edibles in the spring. Morels and ramps, anyone? But the fall is a playground for wild food as well. Once trees start dropping their leaves, Midwesterners in the know start looking for persimmons.
So I'm looking around. Oh, here's one, but it's not ripe yet. It fell with its little branch.
So we'll leave that one for the deer.
We'll leave that one for the deer, and then here's a nice ripe one. I look for the ones that even squish a little when they fall from the tree.
That's Vicki Bassman, Chief of Interpretation for Indiana State Parks and Reservoirs. She's lurking around a tree at Patoka Lake in southern Indiana. Her search isn't really a search at all. The ground is covered with ripe persimmons. From a distance, persimmon-bearing trees are easy to spot, too. Their trunks look to be made up of blocks of bark, like puzzle pieces.
And then in the fall, if it's a good persimmon tree, it's loaded with the persimmons. You can't miss them. And when the leaves start to fall and you're close to your first frost or even after your first frost, they begin to drop. And so most of your country kids know that the good persimmons to eat are the ones on the ground.
That's true. There's a persimmon tree by the playground at Patoka Lake, but those kids have devoured all the ripe ones on the ground. There are still several persimmons hanging from branches like tiny lanterns, but those aren't ready for prime time.
So an unripe persimmon would be one still clinging to the tree. It's a little harder.
It's more yellow than orange.
Mm-hmm. If you want to try just a little taste.
Okay. I've heard this is going to be potent.
Oh.
That's not delicious.
Yeah, you don't want to eat them. And there's some people that they try that and then they'll never try anything persimmon. On the other hand, when they fall from the tree and they're ripe, they sometimes will get kind of this bluish blush on them, and it's real gushy, and then you know it's good and ripe.
My mouth is still dry.
So here, just pop that one in your mouth. The whole thing.
The whole thing?
Just spit the seeds out.
Okay,
yeah.
Here we go.
Sweet, right?
But it's significantly better.
Wait for the final persimmons to drop this fall. Those will probably be even sweeter. Bassman says she could stand under this tree and eat persimmons all day. There's something special about being outside and brushing off the specks of dirt.
Everybody should try and harvest their own just to get the feel for it. So
let me get rid of these seeds. I like it a lot. I'll be right back. I've got like 6 seeds to spit.
We'll spend much of next week at Patoka Lake for their annual Dutch Oven Cook-Off. It was so fun, and we're excited to bring you stories from those cooks. Make sure you don't miss a single word from Earth Eats. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.
'Tis the season for persimmons.
It really is one of my favorite fruits. Some people love it. Some people don't care so much for it. There's also an old wives' tale that if you take the persimmon seed out like I'm doing right here, and you put it in your mouth, and you kind of move it around and try to crack it open. Okay, so I've cracked it in half, and then you open it up, and inside there'll be this little white thing. You see that little white thing in the middle?
Yeah.
Okay, it will look like either one of three things. It will look like a knife, a spoon, or a fork. And if it looks like a knife, which it does this time, it looks like we're going to have very little snow because the snow would fall right through the knife. If it's a fork, the tines of the fork would catch a little bit of the snow. And if it's a spoon, it's going to catch a lot of snow. So you're going to be, you know, inundated with snow for that winter.
Persimmon seeds, handy for predicting the weather, but you don't want them in your persimmon jam. You could pick them out by hand, but it's much easier to use a food mill. This old-timey kitchen tool presses the persimmons, removing the seeds and creating the puree all in one motion.
All right, so that done. You can during persimmon season, pass all your persimmons through a food mill, and then you can freeze it in small containers and use it however you like. Or you can do what we're going to do today. And a lot of people think, you know, persimmon pudding, persimmon bars, but we're going to make a persimmon jam today. And it's a freezer jam, so that means you don't have to worry about sealing it in containers and all that that hard work that usually has. What you're going to do is you're going to cook it down with the sugar, put it in containers, and you just store those containers in the freezer. And there's enough sugar in it that it's not going to really set up hard. And you can just pull it out an hour before you want to use it and put it on your biscuits or however you want to use it up. So we have the persimmon pulp. We have 5 cups, and I'm just going to pour that into a pan. 3 cups of white sugar. 1, 2, 3.
For those of you at home, you should probably measure it if you're not a professional chef.
Okay, and then we're going to add some lemon juice, 1/4 cup. And we're going to season this with a little bit of my sweet spice seasoning.
Hands on. Your hands are in there mixing it.
Just mixing it, of course. You know, if you want to be fancy and use a spoon, you could do that.
You got to wash that. No way.
Okay, I'm going to let you just have a quick little taste so you kind of get a feeling of the direction we're going.
That's great.
Just one last thing that we're going to add. We're going to add a little bit of orange zest. And if you want to make it super fine, you can. But I kind of like to leave the orange peel a little bit chunky. So when you smear this on your toast or your biscuit, you're going to get little pops of orange flavor. All right, so to the stove we go.
From here, you bring it to a simmer and keep it there for 15 to 20 minutes just to thicken it up. This recipe with Daniel Orr was actually from last fall, so that trick he did with cracking the seed open to predict the winter isn't accurate for this year. He saw a knife. Vicki Bassman cracked open a seed for us while we were foraging at Patoka Lake just a few weeks ago.
Looks like a spoon.
Yep. Oh, no. Spoon?
Yeah, so this would tell us that we're going to have a lot of snow and we'll need snow shovels. So you might want to buy one on your way home.
Oh no, I'm going to pretend like I didn't hear that persimmon tree.
Ranchers in the Midwest and the Rocky Mountains have a rich heritage of raising sheep, either for their meat or for wool. Colorado is number 3 in wool production nationwide, despite the fact that the overall sheep herd has been slipping for decades. But as Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports, one entrepreneur is hoping to reinvigorate an old sheep-raising region's wool economy.
Lorraine, I don't mean to make you jump. But...
Inside a small warehouse outside the city of Craig, Colorado, Lorraine Moon and her husband Lewis spend their days turning dirty, oily, scratchy wool into fine yarns. The first thing you notice about Yampa Valley Fiber Works is the humidity.
We keep the humidity up to 88 to 94% to keep the static electricity at bay.
The multi-step process of making yarn starts with a wash to clean out dirt. The raw product is then pulled, tugged, and twisted through a series of machines meant to coax the fibers into manageable strands.
So this is just combing it.
The couple bought the equipment to start milling late last year, and once word got out among those in the area who raise sheep, alpaca, and bison for their fiber, orders started coming in from all over the country.
We're doing some buffalo that's from North Dakota. This particular fleece is just from Walden, yeah.
On another machine, Lorraine feeds long brown alpaca fiber into a machine that coils it into a tall stack.
This has been a fragile fleece. It's needed a little babysitting.
The wool industry has seen a bit of a resurgence in local niche markets. Some sheep ranchers have taken advantage of the local food movement to sell to customers at farmers markets and through community-supported agriculture models. California, Wyoming, and Colorado are heavy hitters in wool. But states like Iowa, Texas, and South Dakota have sizable herds, too.
We have all sorts of teas up here. What would you love?
We leave the milling room for the kitchen for tea and cookies. We're surrounded by finished yarn spun into colorful coils.
Where is our little ball?
Sheep are an indelible part of the culture here in Moffat County, Colorado. The city of Craig plays host to a sheep wagon festival every year. And one of the largest sheepdog competitions in the world is held in nearby Meeker. But Lorraine says the agricultural ties go much deeper.
Down here, you know, it's grown and busted. And agriculture's been kind of the one constant, though, you know, it has subsided a bit too. But it's still kind of the constant that always is here. And so that's kind of the rich part about Moffat County.
Even so, the area has never been home to a large-scale wool processor. And as a small producer, Lorraine says she's unable to take in the massive orders from sheep ranchers nearby.
There's a lot of producers that have their big flock of sheep, and then they might have a little specialty flock of sheep that they do a little extra somethings with. It's small right now, but we do hope that that grows.
Tea time doesn't last long here. Lorraine and her husband Lewis quickly head back into the milling room to keep working. They're still in the first year of production and are taking things slowly, only accepting as much as they can handle. Lewis, a former heavy equipment operator, says that gives quite a bit of time to let the mind wander while working.
Every fleece has its own personality. It's just like people. We have not run across two fleeces that were identical yet. Every one of them has a different little twist or something to it.
And the couple's happy to keep discovering those new twists along the way together. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
In case you missed Harvest Public Media's coverage of food waste in America, let me gently nudge you to their website to read and listen to their work. It is top-notch. HarvestPublicMedia.org. Stay tuned in the second half of our show today to hear a conversation with a local alpaca farmer who sets up a table to sell yarn at the farmer's market.
Then...
It's so hard to get people to think about food as something political. You know, they just can't do it.
Political science senior lecturer Christine Barber teaches first and second year college students about the politics of what's for dinner. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. You are tuned to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan at the Bloomington Winter Farmers Market.
I'm Kathy Crossan, and our farm is Red Rosa Farm in Owen County.
So what are you selling today? This maybe is the most unique table at the market.
Well, thank you very much. We have the alpaca yarns. We have a herd of upwards of 100 alpacas.
So talk me through the lifespan of the yarn, how it goes from being on the alpaca to being on the table here ready to be sold.
Well, we shear in the late spring when it's reliably warm enough and so the animals don't get hot in the summer. My partner, Kenny, hand shears them with just fabric shears, all 100-odd animals, just gently without restraint because we didn't like the professional shearers who come in and are kind of rough with the animals. And we have the bags of fleece that I then combine into color lots, and I hand wash them and pick them free of debris, and then I take them in color batches to a mill.
Well, it's beautiful. Do you knit or crochet yourself?
Oddly, I don't. I have come to this from the animal side of things, and so I have to fake it that I know anything about knitting. And
I have to touch this. It's so soft. This makes me wish I knit so I could make myself some socks or something from this. Thank you. I really appreciate this.
You are so welcome.
That conversation was from a couple years ago. Winter farmers markets in the area haven't started up just yet. Oh, and if you've never actually seen an alpaca, get to the website right away. They are cute. EarthEats.org. Every time we step foot into Mother Hubbard's cupboard, they're doing something incredible. From cooking demonstrations to gardening classes, these programs are free and open to the pantry's customers. Many of them wander into the teaching kitchen from the pantry when they smell good smells. What do we have today? Looks like squash soup on the stove and bones in bags on the counter. Here's Mark Chilla.
My name is Barbara Lair. They call me the domestic diva. And every Friday, I give tutorials and demonstrations about foods that help heal our bodies. Today, we're doing a special topic on bone broth.
Barbara is one of the many volunteers who teaches cooking classes at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. And today, she's brought in a delicious squash soup prepared with her easy-to-make bone broth.
In my home, I have a stock pot going almost all the time. Even though that seems like an odd practice, that was the standard practice before 1930s. Everybody had it. As a matter of fact, I've seen an old-fashioned stove that has 3 burners and 1 hole. In that hole, you put a stock pot in, and you had perpetual broth going all the time.
People come to these classes to learn new, healthy recipes that they can hopefully incorporate into their life, like Michael Holland. He's one of the patrons at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard.
All the recipes I've found for it always have a bunch of sodium in it, and I can't have sodium. So I was trying to figure out whether or not she'd come up with a different way.
Bone broth is not only healthy, it's frugal too. You're using parts of the animal that you would otherwise just throw away. Plus, it's versatile.
Vegetables. You use it to make your rice, so you make a pilaf instead of straight rice. Broth is the basis of the best sauces, the best soups, the best gravies, the best stews. So if you go to a very high-end restaurant, they will boil their own bones. And that's why it tastes so wonderful.
Part of the mission of Mother Hubbard's Cupboard is to demonstrate just how easy it is for people to make their own healthy food using only simple ingredients. For instance, the ingredients of bone broth are really just bones, water, and thyme.
We'll take bones, we'll roast them, and then we'll put them in a pot, cover them with water, put it to a simmer, and leave it for 24 hours. When we roast them, it's because it gives it a kind of a nuttier flavor. It gives it more dimension to the taste. Some people will put a bay leaf in and peppercorns and a little bit of vinegar to pull the minerals out of the bones.
As Barbara explains, like any recipe, you can add your own personal touch to the broth.
But the basics are just bones, water, simmered.
The broth can last about 5 days in the refrigerator, 6 months in the freezer, and about a year if it's canned. It smells and tastes great, but it may not look that great after it's refrigerated. The gelatin from the bones makes its consistency a little like jelly when cooled.
It'll gel in the refrigerator. They'll freak out and think that it's gone bad when it's actually fantastic.
After the demonstration, Michael, our patron, gets a chance to taste that squash soup made with Barbara's chicken bone broth.
That's actually pretty good. You know, you can taste the chicken. What is it, got basil and oregano? That's pretty good.
Now he has the recipe, plus he gets to take some beef bones home to try it out himself. And as Barbara explains, you can cook these beef bones about 3 times before all of the nutrients are out of them. After that, give them to your dogs. They'll love them. For Earth Eats, I'm Mark Chilla.
Christine Barber teaches the course The Politics of What's for Dinner at Indiana University. Her students are mostly first and second year kids who, she says, have never really thought about the power of their food choices before. I caught up with her last year after she gave a talk to students called If You Are What You Eat, Then What Are You?
It's so hard to get people to think about food as something political. You know, they just can't do it. And they also can't think of political as anything other than you go to the government and you try to get a law passed. You know, the idea that we could have politics in your family, you know, if they, well, who does the cooking in your house? Well, it's mostly my mom. That's interesting. Why is it mostly your mom? Oh, she likes it. Oh, really? She really likes to cook? And if your dad does the cleaning up and you help do the shopping, I might buy that, but if she's cleaning, shopping, and cooking, maybe she doesn't like it as much as you think she does. The idea that our rural roots, our ethnic roots, say something about who we are. So the fact that you have pierogi every holiday and that you sit in the kitchen and you make those pierogi with your grandmother and she tells you what the old country is like, that's about your identity and that's about power. You know, the U.S. government used to try to get immigrant women not to cook the foods of their homelands because they wanted people to be homogenous, but what they told them was spaghetti is bad for your health. You know, thank God they didn't listen.
Well, one of the things you said today, spoken like a true political science professor, every food choice you make is a vote. Can you describe what you mean by that?
Well, I'd like to say that idea originates with me, but I've heard other people make the same argument. How many food choices do you think you make in a day? You know, you get up in the morning, you have to have breakfast. Do you have breakfast? Do you not have breakfast? If you have breakfast, do you eat it in the car? Do you sit down at the table and eat it? Do you have morning TV on while you watch it or eat it? Or do you just sit down and focus and eat mindfully your egg? And that egg, did that egg come from Marsh? Did it come from a farmer? If it came from Marsh, did it come from a free-range chicken or a regular pent-up chicken? And if it came from a free-range chicken, do you realize that that chicken probably didn't live any differently than the pent-up chicken? Because all free-range means legally is that there's a door that the chicken could go out of its pen if it knew to try. Already, you've got a whole bunch of choices right there, and we have not even gotten you out the door. to try to eat in a truly sustainable way all the time would be an enormous amount of energy and time and resources. I don't know anybody who can do it unless you happen to live on a farm and be completely, you know, everything, you bring in everything and everything, you know. It's not a perfect world, but you try to get most of your votes in the basket of the way you want to live. Because really what you're doing every time you spend a dollar is you're casting a vote for the world you want to live in. But what I want my students to do is to be thoughtful about how they eat. If they decide they want to eat at McDonald's, then I just want them to know what that means. You know, there's two ways you can eat McDonald's. One, you can eat McDonald's with your head in the sand, which makes it hard to chew. But you could, you know, you can do it with, you know, being oblivious to the consequences, or you can say, I don't give a damn. I want to eat this burger. My philosophy about teaching in general is you don't have to come out of here thinking like me. You just have to come out of here thinking. And that itself would be a huge victory.
Think about all the classes that you've taught, the different students who've come through your door. What is the one issue that the majority of students are just flabbergasted to find out about? GMOs, the hidden cost of food, the environmental impact, what?
I think the thing that shakes them up the most, which is sort of, I mean, I show Food Inc. and everyone's a vegetarian for about 50 minutes to a week. There's, you know, just, oh God, there's the gross factor when they see it. So I think they're surprised at that. But the biggest problem I've had teaching the food politics class is getting students to not think that they are autonomous. They say, oh, I eat McDonald's because I like it the best. I like it better than Burger King. I drink Coke because I think Coke tastes much better than Pepsi. Well, when you went to school, were there Cokes or Pepsis? Oh, well, there were Cokes because my school had a contract. Well, do you think that had any impact on your liking of Coke because you're used to it? Oh, no, I choose Coke. I mean, they don't see that their food choices are the result of anything other than individual choice. So there's lots of things that, from the lighting in the restaurant to the label on the wine bottle to the music that's playing to the colors on the walls. There's lots of things that affect their food choices.
Last question for me. I want to ask you the question that is in the name of your talk. If you are what you eat, then who are you was the name of the talk. So who, Christine Barber, are you?
I am mostly an eggplant. I am a thoughtful person who tries to get it right most of the time. I'm a person who once in a while craves a steak. I just want the choices.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Christine Barber, part eggplant, part political scientist, part senior lecturer at Indiana University. She shared a killer sweet potato recipe with us. Find that at eartheats.org.
Can't pronounce her name, but eggplant is her game.
Shout out to our Earth Eats crew: Avon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, Casey Zakin, and the team at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Be in touch on Twitter. We're at Earth Eats. Till next week, I'm Annie Corrigan.